Accession number 27347, Reel 12.
Stanley Brown, Reel 12. You were explaining to me off the tape one obstacle that you had a near encounter with when you were doing a landing.
Yes, I was doing a landing in a field. Actually, not in my training days. It was when I was flying microlights in 1990, where I put down in a field and suddenly, to my horror, realised that there was a telephone wire going across the field at about 20 feet up. And it was a single wire because it was the farmer's telephone. And he'd watched the boar bees when it was being installed, and he'd used a dead tree in one place, and he'd used very, very thin poles in another place. The poles were only about 4-inch diameter, and I hadn't noticed them. And I came into land here. Fortunately, I'd touched down, and I was rolling by the time I got to the wire. But it made me very nervous about takeoff, because you can't always hold a plane down safely to go under something, and if you allow the wheels to come off the ground, 20 feet isn't a lot with the height of an aeroplane. I felt very nervous about single wire farmer's telephone. They were very, very handy when you'd had a forced landing. You could go to the farmhouse, apologise to the farmer for landing in his field without permission, and hand over the half bottle of whiskey that I used to carry in a microlight, make your apologies and say, "May I use your telephone to get some help to get me out of here?" You might... when I flew microlights in my first 25 hours, I had 3 forced landings through engine failure. It was a Rotax engine, twin cylinder, 500 cc's, and the cylinders were behind each other in line, and the rear one used to overheat. So I had 3 forced landings in the first 25 hours, and my experience helped me no end.
I was going to say, though, with training, obviously you were coming along okay with your training, but had there been any accidents with any of your contemporaries during that period?
Yes, there was one accident, which was engine failure on takeoff, which distracted him no end. And he forgot to keep his airspeed up, and he spun in and was killed. It was an excellent illustration to us to land straight ahead if you have an engine failure. Never try and turn round and go back.
It's an interesting point that you make there, because although it was a very sad event, in many respects, did that bring things home to you quite clearly?
Oh, it did. Not only that, it caused a lot of discussion. This chap actually tried to turn round. That's why he lost his airspeed, because he lost... he was trying to keep his height. And if you turn and try to keep your height and haven't an engine, you lose airspeed. And if you lose airspeed below stall, you spin in, and that's what happened to him. If you turn round and try to go back, even if you don't stall it, you've got a tailwind, and you're going so fast that when you do land, you need twice as much landing space, and you never have it. So you're going to hit something, and you hit it at a fast speed. So never turn round. It causes a lot of discussion in a class of trainee pilots. They all learn something from it. But the really distressing time comes when you have a service to bury him. And we were never excused from that. All the bearers were appointed from the class. We all went to the service. Some were trained to fire a shot over the grave. Yes, I had too many of those experiences, one way and another.
With obviously the engine failure and attempting to turn back into the airfield, what would have been the best course of action?
Land straight ahead, even if the field's short and you're going to hit something at the other end. At least your airspeed will be as low as you can make it. So the impact is going to be as light as you can make it. And the chances are, an airfield is not usually built up on the edge of a built-up area. There's generally some fields around it. And since your engine failure takes place on the climb out, you've got the maximum length of landing space in front of you. The fields don't always run in the direction you'd like them to, and to do any turn loses your height, so loses your distance. No, the rule was land straight ahead, no matter what obstacles.
Was overconfidence amongst the pilots once they'd soloed, was that a problem at all?
No, generally going solo was such a boost to one's confidence. To be able to write home and say, "Mum, I went solo today. Dad, you would have been proud of me today." It was wonderful, a wonderful morale booster.
I was just wondering if people afterwards got a little bit too overconfident in some of the way that they would handle the aircraft.
Well, that did happen, but instructors were well aware of that failing and would take you down a peg or two. They'd start criticising every little thing if they thought you were getting overconfident.
Also, the question of what you actually did right after soloing seems to have taken you back almost, although there was the nice element of the instrument flying.
Yeah,
there was some very
something
routine,
new.
But there was also some very routine stuff in there as well, wasn't
there? Oh, yes. And there was a lot to learn. It taught you that you were still a long way from being a pilot.
So, obviously, after soloing, you mentioned some of the things that you did. Were you able to take an aircraft up on your own after that period?
Oh, yes. I'm just referring to my logbook again to see how long it was between my first solo, my second flight, and my third flight. But then, I did my first solo after 8 hours, 45 minutes of tuition, dual tuition. But then it was another 6 hours, 6.5 hours before I went solo again. We had a run of bad weather, but I did quite a bit of flying dual 6 hours, 35 minutes, practicing things that I'd done for the solo, and getting onto instrument flying, which was it was all progress.
You mentioned obviously there was a time delay, and the weather played an element in that. How bad was the weather? Because you were doing it in February, weren't you?
Yes. Oh, we had periods where only one of the tiger moths could be started, the other impossible to start, and they had to go in into the hangar for servicing. Even the instructors wouldn't fly at times. Visibility was way down. I remember having difficulty checking where I was, even though I was on the circuit. I was having difficulty checking where to turn in, because the ground was obscured by the murky weather. It was very, very bad. I got flu as well. I got flu and lost so much time in sick bay that I had to go back a course. I had to come off the course I was on and join the next one as it came up. They came up each fortnight. And during that time, I got some extra ground tuition as well.
So in actual fact, it was playing quite a good grounding for your flying abilities then, was it really? The slight delay was helping you to practice and re-practice.
Yes, it was a help. Yes, nothing lost. Just like extra experience in driving a car, it's never wasted.
So what happened as the course came to an end at Sealand? What was the final sort of things that you would have to do there?
It was unremarkable. The only remarkable thing is one photo I've got in my collection is in the naffy with bottles of beer and saying goodbye to the boys that were going to go to Pensacola, join the Americans for training, instead of going to Kingston, joining the Canadians for training.
How much knowledge did you have of your destination for training then prior to going to Canada? Have you been divided up into where you will be going?
Personal preference was taken into consideration to a certain degree. There was a little bit of coercion. They tended to, some instructors tended to try and persuade people to go to Canada because they said that you'd get a better training there. Another said that if you go to America, to Pensacola, you'll be trained on more modern aeroplanes, so that you'll probably end up on Avengers instead of Swordfish. You know, there's quite a bit of influence there.
Another thing, at that stage, did you know what type of aircraft you were likely to be flying?
No, you tended to know whether you wanted to be a fighter or a bomber pilot. But that was outside your choice. The course instructors would decide what your end job was going to be.
And would that have been at this very early stage in your elementary training?
There was a certain amount of it. There'd be recommendations in our private papers.
Does it, at that stage, does it take a different type of pilot to do the sort of fighter pilot side?
Oh, yes.
The torpedo bombing?
Yes, very definitely. It's the difference between a driver who will drive in London traffic and never refer to a map because he's got it up here, and a bloke who will drive a Ferrari on the racing track. They were the pilots. The bloke who could navigate in London against traffic coming from every direction was going to be the TBR.
It's interesting because the skills are slightly different, I think, aren't they, than the RAF, where many people would have considered the pinnacle almost to be the fighter pilot. And many people would then end up on the bomber aircraft, and usually the choice would always have been fighter pilot first, then bomber. With the Fleet Air Arm, they're completely different skills, aren't they? Both needing to be equally good in different ways.
Yes, but in a way, when you're out at sea, you're more likely to be going for a capital ship than you are a fighter aircraft. So there's more work for the TBR man than there is for the fighter pilot. On leave. And having been on leave, we reported back and we were sent up to Blackpool. At Blackpool, we were billeted with the local landladies. This was in January 1943, when it was a quiet time and they were glad to make a bit of money. The trouble is that they always wanted to make a bit of more money. The food that they dished up to us was very Spartan. Their rules were very, very strict about the time we got up, the time we made our beds, the time we got out, the time we came back. They didn't want us hanging around during the day. They just wanted rid of us as soon as possible, as long as they got the money.
How did you fill your days?
We wandered around. In bad weather, it was pretty grim. We used to go along to the Naffy, where we could read newspapers and mix with our friends. And I suppose Right Home was one of the most time-consuming occupations. We did spend some time in the amusement palaces, but we hadn't the money for it. Some of the boys spent time chasing the landlady's daughter too, but that was usually lacking in any result. They had too much experience of the comings and goings of trainee air crew.
What was Blackpool like? Was there lots of servicemen based in Blackpool at that time?
At that time, yes, there was at least 1,000 potential air crew coming and going. In fact, they used to bring a train into Squire's Gate and load up with about 300 servicemen to go up to Glasgow. That's what happened to us. Or to go to Southampton. It depended where you were going, whether you were going to South Africa or New Zealand or... Blackpool consisted largely of parades. They were always checking up that we were still there, that we hadn't sloped off home. Snap parades and roll calls, just keeping track of us. It was a boring time. Falling in on the front there and doing route marches in all sorts of weather wasn't very funny. We were glad when the word did come eventually that we were to board a train.
How long had you been there?
About 3 weeks. I suppose it took that time to organise the paperwork. When the train did come alongside these terrific platforms at Squire's Gate, I think our train was about 13 carriages long. Huge and slow. No corridor. There were all the individual compartments. And I'm sorry, I'm trying to remember the details. But we were loaded into these compartments. I think we were 10 to a compartment. We were given a packed meal. No drink with it. And no toilet facilities. And we were packed off from Squire's Gate up to the Clyde. We seemed to spend most of the time in sidings or shunted to let an express go past. If I remember correctly, it took us about 16 or 17 or 18 hours to get up to Glasgow without toilet facilities. We were peeing out of the window. And in dire extremes, I know that people defecated into newspapers and threw it out the window. We were desperate for drinks, and I must pass comment here for posterity. The ladies who walked Carlisle platforms with a trolley with jam jars, dishing out tea to all and sundry without taking any payment. It didn't have much sugar in it, and if you didn't take sugar, that's hard luck, you got it. The milk was watery milk. You didn't want too much anyway because it would have cooled off the not too hot tea. But the women did a wonderful job trying to keep tea hot in old-fashioned urns. Must have been difficult, and they never had a timetable saying there'll be a train coming in at such and such a time at such and such a platform. It was all done on spec because we didn't know how long we'd be either. You'd end up in a siding somewhere, and nobody knew how long we were going to be there. We were just going from A to B and had to be content. A lot of time was spent sleeping on that journey. People got up on the racks, which gave a bit more room on the seats. Everybody was spreading out and zizzing. But it was a bit of a nightmare. When we have eventually arrived in Goorock on the Clyde, we sat in the train for, I don't know, a couple of hours. Nobody came near us. Nobody told us what was happening. We were hoping for a hot meal. We were eventually detrained into a big warehouse, which was cold and drafty, no heating. There were trestle tables in there without any chairs. And they served up bacon and beans. Bacon and beans, yes. I can't remember how it was served. It was before the days of paper plates, but there was something disposable. I think it was like we used to get fish and chips in those days with a square of greaseproof paper in a newspaper. But unlike the RAF, we didn't have our own eating irons. The RAF all... So we were faced with bacon and beans and nothing to eat them with. We didn't even have our own mugs, but the RAF did. one or two jam jars appeared, whether they were the ones that had been salvaged from Carlisle Station, and whether they'd been used for urination before throwing it out of the carriage window, I don't know. But a few jam jars appeared, and these were filled with tea and passed around. We took our turn at them. It, terrible disorganisation. Nobody knew what was happening. We went to the doors and windows of the warehouse to look out, and there in the at the tail of the bank in the Clyde was this beautiful great passenger liner. It was the Queen Elizabeth. But with our experience of the disorganisation that had gone so far, the rumour went round that we were going to have to swim out to her. Eventually, we were told to fall in outside, and we did, and a Clyde steamer, a Clyde passenger steamer came alongside, and we were let loose on this. We were hanging all over the place, hanging over the rails, and that took us out to the Queen Elizabeth. And from the moment we came alongside the doorway, which was, I suppose, 6 feet above water level, that doorway opened, and as soon as we were able to get inside there, the whole picture changed. It was luxury, comfort, and plenty of everything. We hadn't been aboard for more than a few minutes. We were shown to our cabin, which was a cabin on the upper deck. I suppose it was first class in the passenger days, but we were six to a cabin, with hammocks, not hammocks, trestle beds that pulled down, a metal frame and a wire, sprung wire mattress in it. But we had white sheets, and we had white pillowcases, and we had pillows, and we had freshly laundered blankets, and we were told to newly arrived personnel report to the dining room at once. And we went and we had our first hot meal at the tables, which had immaculate tablecloths, dishes with a half pound pat of butter in it, rolls, freshly baked rolls, white bread, not the brown floor sweepings that we were used to. It was luxury. We were ready for Aziz, of course, and as soon as we'd finished the meal, we went back to this cabin, had a job finding it, because the place was huge and nothing was signposted, and for lots of people it was the first time aboard a ship. We eventually got to our cabins and had a sleep. In exploring, some of us wanted to explore rather than we wanted to sleep. We were appalled at the desecration of the Elizabeth. It had been used for transporting a lot of American troops over, and they'd carved initials and dates and hometowns and so on into the teak banisters, the teak handrails, and they'd scrawled things in the lovely wardrobes, mahogany wardrobes. We were appalled at the vandalism.